This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Homage to the Blessed One, the Perfected One, the Fully Self-Enlightened One. Thank you. Thank you to Insight Meditation South Bay, and thank you for all of you who are attending. Many of you are friends of mine or family or students, and of those also, it's really fun to see you guys. I have to admit, it's a delight and a surprise. We were commenting before the beginning of the session, we were just chatting a little bit about how at least in my case, how infrequent it is that I get to see my friends, and how often how rare it is now that I even get a chance to talk. So tonight's talk is going to be both a treat and an adventure. Not having given a public talk in about a year and not having talked to many of you in as long a period of time, the vocal cords and the creative energies are in a spring-like coming out of hibernation. But I am very grateful and very thankful to be here this evening. In effect, I've been invited to offer this talk as an introduction and as a way of introducing us to the book that I wrote just recently called A Householder's Vinaya with Home and Sangha Retreat Guides. And to perhaps give it a context, I think it'll be valuable for me to give some background on why it was that it was written, why I chose to write it. And in order to do that, I have to give you, or I'm going to choose to offer you just a little bit of my background. And that is that approximately around about 1987 or so, I had switched my career, and I became able to start taking a good period of the year each year for longish retreats. And so since 1987 until just this last year, almost annually, I've been able to go on fairly long retreats here, there, and everywhere. Not everywhere, but here, there, and many places. And one of the things that I discovered over and over and over again, and for those of you who have also done retreats, perhaps you'll be able to echo this testimonial, is that despite the amount of practice I would do, two things were true. One is at the end of retreats, whether it was a 10-day retreat or a 3-month retreat, whatever it might be, more often than not, much more often than not, the instructions at the end of the retreat would be, whether it be a lay teacher or a monastic, they would say, be more mindful. And that would be the instructions that we would be given to go home after being, however long you might have been in retreat, practicing sati, practicing vipassana, practicing insight. And we would be, I would be back out in the world. And in a fairly short period of time, despite all of my good intentions, I would find that my practice would devolve into old patterns of behavior fairly rapidly. It was this quality of not receiving, or not the quality, this situation of not getting really strong instructions at the end of retreat, and the subsequent, or not necessarily directly linked to, but then my practice dropping off and then beginning again after 6 months or 9 months or whatever it might be to do another retreat, basically having to regenerate the engine and not having any direct instructions on what to do during those 6 or 9 months of everyday life in order to be able to sustain or deepen my practice. And more often than not, I would be getting my instructions from monastics. I'd be in a monastery or in a lay retreat center being led by a monastic, and they would be giving me an instruction that was very valuable to them, because that's basically what they would be instructed to do for themselves, is be more mindful. But there's a huge difference between a lay person and a monastic at the end of retreat. And what might that be? Well, one is that a monastic, when they leave retreat, they go into a lifetime or a lifestyle that is regulated and supported by their vinaya, or the Patimokkha, the vinaya pitika. Whereas lay people are just given the instructions about being more mindful and do the best you can. It's here that I was motivated, because I didn't feel as though I had sufficient instruction or sufficient skill in my meditation practice to be able to sustain the mindfulness and the compassion and the concentration that I had developed on retreat, to be able to have it sustain into everyday life, that I decided to begin to explore what it was that differentiated, or what was the difference between a monastic's experience in their daily life and lay people in their daily life, and what made the monastic's experience more supportive for sustaining the insights realized on retreat into their daily life, whereas those same kinds of supports may or may not have been, you know, are not necessarily as easily accessible to the layperson in their daily life. So this is where we, I'm just out of curiosity, and also to be able to maybe tailor the discussion a little bit better, if I understand how many of us, and this is where, Jen, this is voting time, how many of those in attendance tonight have ever done a residential retreat? Yes means you have, no means you have not.
Okay, so we have 33 yeses and 7 noes. And there are a number of people on the phone who can't vote, so.
All right. So I imagine statistically it'll probably remain pretty much the same. Out of those 40 people, my second question is, after your retreat, did you experience anything similar to my experience that your practice fell off and didn't have necessarily a template or instructions sufficient to carry you further on in your practice in your everyday life? If your practice dropped off, yes. If your practice didn't drop off and you were able to deepen your practice, that would be a no.
Okay, the votes are coming in. And have reached 28 people, 29 people say yes, their experience is similar to yours, and 5 people saying no.
Oh. at the end of our session, if you would care to contact me, I'd really like to have discussions with those 5 people. I'd like to learn some of the tools or skills that you've developed, so perhaps I can add and learn something from your experience. But I think generally speaking, those of us who have tried to do meditation or have gone on retreat will say that that it isn't easy to translate or sustain our practice, our sati practice, in our everyday lives after a retreat, or even our daily practices. Thank you. Where we have to go, I think, now to be able to discuss what the householder's vinaya is about, there are 3 main concepts that they're really more than concepts. They're Pali words that are really practices of in and of themselves. And the 3 words that I'd like to discuss and define tonight in order for us to understand what is a householder's vinaya are sati, sampajana, and vinaya. These 3 words are Pali words that, generally speaking, and I'll get into the specific, sati generally means and is often meant to mean mindfulness. Sampajana means clear comprehension. And vinaya means, generally speaking, the rules or the culture of being a monastic. 2 of these terms are used frequently in the sutta that is most commonly seen as the bedrock of Vipassana meditation, and that's the Satipatthana Sutta. I'm fairly certain that most of you who have any meditation experience have heard about the Satipatthana Sutta. It's here, which is translated as the foundations of mindfulness. And there are 4 foundations of mindfulness. And this particular discourse, sutta, is commonly seen as the bedrock of Vipassana meditation. And in it, sati is explained and described, as is sampajana. It's explained and described. Fortunately or unfortunately, because of a historical context of how we in the West are receiving this kind of meditation, it has come mostly through a retreat environment. And the retreat environment is usually led by either a monastic or lay people who have been taught by monastics. So we're receiving our teachings in these retreat centers and these monasteries from either directly a monastic perspective, or we're receiving it through a lay interpretation or a lay influenced monastic experience. And why is that important? Well, one of the things that's important about it is that while we're on retreat, the emphasis of our practices is on sati. And I'll get to defining sati in a few minutes. And for the 9 days or the 3 days or the 3 months or 6 months, whatever it might be, we are constantly just doing sati practice. We're doing mindfulness practice hour after hour, day after day, week after week. And as a consequence, the practice is very focused on this particular style of meditation, which is nurtured and supported in the retreat environment. It's an exclusive and really precious place to be able to practice sati, because it's very difficult to practice sati in everyday life. So we're on retreat or we're doing our daily practice and we're not listening to music while we're doing sati. We're not doing other things. We're simply doing what we were doing in our meditation that we began tonight's talk in the guided meditation. We're simply looking at our experiences in as simple and as direct a way as possible in order to be able to train the mind to see our experience from a different perspective than what we normally do. Normally, in our everyday life, we are constantly interpreting, we're constantly giving concept, we are constantly judging and manipulating and pushing away and holding on to our experiences, which separates us from the direct experience of what is a sound. What is a sensation? What is a sight? What is a taste? What is a thought? On retreat, we're able to see these experiences in a very rendered fashion, very basic. And as a consequence, we begin to see the world in an entirely new way. It's quite remarkable to see an object or to hear a sound and not have a concept or a judgment to be associated with it. It just is. But it doesn't necessarily work very well in everyday life in that same way. And also, on retreat, this thing called clear comprehension or sampajana is taken care of. We are living in an environment when on retreat that is so precious and so protected, we don't have to make choices. We're not talking to other people. In this particular tradition, in this Vipassana Theravada style practice that most of us are familiar with here, when we're on retreat, we are limiting our experience and giving ourselves the opportunity to practice sati. But it's sampajana that is necessary for us to be able to understand and to be able to navigate when we're in our everyday world, but it isn't instructed to us because we are on retreat. We're being instructed in sati. So I'd like to give you a definition for sati. I think and I'm going to give you definitions for both for sati sampajana and for vinaya, and try to bring it together so that we can understand why a householder's vinaya will be relevant to us, why it is valuable to us, and how it can be functionally used. So this is from the Comprehensive Manual of Abhidhamma. And they defined it, or it's defined in that book, sati is defined in that book, as being derived from the root meaning to remember. But as a mental factor, it signifies presence of mind, attentiveness to the present, rather than the faculty of memory regarding the past. It has the characteristic of not wobbling, i.e. not floating away from the object. Its function is absence of confusion or non-forgetfulness. It is manifested as guardianship or as the state of confronting an objective field. Its proximate cause is strong perception or the four foundations of mindfulness. Well, that's well and good. You know, that's a definition, but what does it mean? What does this mean? And Bhante Gudaratna, he describes sati in this way. When this mindfulness is prolonged by using proper techniques, you will find that this experience is profound, and it changes your entire view of the universe. When mindfulness is prolonged by using proper techniques, you find that this experience is profound and it changes your entire view of the universe. This state of perception has to be learned, however, and it takes regular practice. Once you learn the technique, you will find that mindfulness has many interesting aspects. Mindfulness is mirror thought. Mirror thought. It reflects only what is presently happening and in exactly the way it is happening. There are no biases. There's no judgment. There's no manipulation. There's no liking. There's no disliking. Simply being present. Mindfulness is non-judgmental observation. It is that ability of the mind to observe without criticism. With this ability, one sees things without condemnation or judgment. One is surprised by nothing. One simply takes a balanced interest in things exactly as they are in their natural states. One does not decide and does not judge. One just observes sati and what it can do. And in an hour's meditation or on a weekend's meditation, this is what we're cultivating. We're again and again back to our anchor, just simply being present for the sensations or the sound or the smell or the taste, whatever it might be. We're simply learning how to be present at a very elemental fashion so that we can understand what our physical experience is without concept, without judgment, without manipulation, without trying to hold on, without trying to push away. We're simply being present. And it teaches us things. It's like what Gudaratna says, experience is profound and it changes your entire view of the universe. But there often is a but. Jnanapanika, Tara, adds to this discussion by saying, the receptive and detached attitude of mindfulness can and should certainly occupy far greater room in our mental life than it usually does. But this should not make us forget the fact that mindfulness can generally be maintained only during a limited time of ordinary life apart from periods expressly given to its application. I think this is one of those sentences that I'd like to reread. I think this is extremely important in terms of how we hold what mindfulness can do for us, and when it's done properly, how it can be applied. Let me read that sentence again, what Jnanapanika Tara says. But this should not make us forget the fact that mindfulness can generally be maintained only during a limited time of ordinary life, apart from periods expressly given to its application. Every hour of the day demands some activity by deed, word, or thought. First, there are numerous demands for bodily activity or movement, be it only that a change of posture becomes necessary. We have also again and again to abandon the protection of self-sufficiency of silence and enter into relationship with others through speech, and the mind too cannot avoid defining its position to itself and to the outer world and issuing orders for actions innumerable times during the day. Mind has to choose to decide and to judge. Now, I think Jnanapanika is discussing a fairly developed mind, and he's also describing someone probably on retreat. He's not talking about getting into the automobile and going to the grocery store. he's just talking about talking to folks and moving your arm. So, but I think he's pointing to the insufficiency that we have when we think that one type of meditation, or this thing that we think we understand as mindfulness, as being the only and the true way of practice, that there are no other ways in which we can support sati and also support ourselves in our everyday lives. There is a story I heard, I included in the book, about a yogi who went to her teacher at the end of a retreat and asked the teacher, Venerable, I plan to sit 1 hour a day when I get off of retreat. Is 1 hour a day of meditation after this retreat going to be sufficient for me to deepen or support my practice? And the teacher says to the woman, he says, imagine if you will, 24 people. Imagine if you will, 23 of those people in a tug of war, and each of these 24 people represent 1 hour. And now imagine, please, a tug of war between 23 and 1. I think what he's saying is that simply doing 1 hour of meditation a day, though good, though valuable, though important, is perhaps insufficient to be able to sustain our practices. Well, if that's the case, and because we're householders, and many of us are able only to do maybe 1 hour of practice a day, and some of us are lucky enough to do a couple hours of a formal meditation practice a day, what's one to do? Well, it's those other 23 hours that became an issue for me between retreats. How do I create a vehicle, an avenue that allows me to maintain an intention and a continuity of investigation and the energy and the sufficient investigative qualities that permit me to maintain a momentum that may not be exactly like sati, but will support my sati in this other way? And there is a way, and it's taught to us in the Satipatthana Sutta, and it's called Sampajana. Sampajana, which is called clear comprehension, which has it's mentioned 11 times in the Satipatthana Sutta, but is very rarely discussed by our teachers and in our sanghas. Sampajana is in fact the Buddhist teachings for how we can support sati and cultivate another way of practice that allows us to deepen our understanding of what we have done on retreat. This, I want to define Sampajana, but this is, those of you who know Bhikkhu Anilayo may understand that he may be a little terse. Let's see if we can break down what he says here. He defines Sampajana this way. Such cooperation of mindfulness with clear comprehension, which according to the definition is required for all satipatthana contemplations. You heard, I mentioned that in Satipatthana, Sampajñana is mentioned 11 times. This is what he's referring to, that Satipatthana contemplations are Sati and Sampajñana. Points to the need to combine mindful observation of phenomena with an intelligent processing of the observed data. Like I say, he's good. What he's saying here is that sati without reflection, without reflection, he says it. Thus, to clearly know can be taken to represent the illuminating or awakening aspect of contemplation. Analio concludes, the interaction between sati and wisdom is described in the commentaries, distinguishes between sati with and without wisdom, showing that wisdom is not an automatic result of the presence of sati, but needs to be deliberately developed on the importance of combining sati with sampajñana. But what's sampajñana? So what Analio is saying is that sati without sampajñana is insufficient to get the wisdom that we hope to gain from our study of meditation. But what is sampajñana? Sampajñana, as in clear comprehension, is the reflective nature. In the book, I say, sampajñana is the wholesome attempt to understand what an object or action is, what it can do, and what to do in order to incline the mind towards wholesomeness. Sampajñana is in fact why we meditate. We meditate in order to be able to purify the mind, to try and allow ourselves to become more wholesome. These are qualities of sampajñana. The commentaries describe sampajñana in four different categories: purpose, suitability, domain, and reality. What these terms mean is it asks us, the Buddha tells us what sampajñana is his son, Rahula, was about 7 years old when he ordained. And the Buddha in the suttas, in the discourses, tells Rahula this. He says, after reflecting again and again, actions by deed, word, and thought should be done. Before doing such actions by deed, word, and thought, while doing things and after doing them, one should reflect thus. Does this action lead to the harm or benefit of myself, to the harm or benefit of others, to the harm or benefit of both? After reflecting again and again, one should purify one's action by deed, word, and thought. What the Buddha is telling Rahula is in fact what sampajñana is all about. That we have as an opportunity in our daily lives to not only bring our meditative mind, our sati, our mindfulness mind to an experience, but we are also responsible to be able to ask and to be aware and to direct our lives towards every single action we possibly can embrace with the questions of whether or not before, during, and or after, does this action, this thought, speech, or action benefit self, others, or doesn't benefit self, others, or both? For me, personally, that's redundant. This particular sutta which is the Buddha speaking to Rahula, was perhaps the most important sutta I ever read. It gave me permission and gave me the responsibility to start being accountable in my daily life, not just with mindfulness, but asking myself the questions of whether or not this is any action, any thought, anything that I would say, I could filter it through the precepts. I could filter it through the paramis. I could filter it through ways in which I could then question myself and become accountable to myself that anything I do is in fact a training for the cultivation of a more wholesome state of mind. Well, this sort of brings us to discussing a little bit about what is a Vinaya and why monastics have a particularly ideal environment in which to be able to move from retreat practice to everyday life. A Vinaya. The word Vinaya is derived from a Sanskrit verb that can mean to lead, take away, train, tame, or guide, or alternately, to educate or teach. It is often translated as discipline, often used by the Buddha to refer to his complete teachings, suggesting its integral role in Buddhist practice. In Theravada, male monastics take 227 vows. Bhikkhunis, where they're accepted, take 311 vows. And many of them appear to be really, really archaic and often very, you know, pretzel-making, crazy types of rules. And I would ask myself, well, the history is kind of interesting, but I don't think we really have the time to get into it. But what made me become really appreciative of the very archaic, very picayune way that the Vinaya regulates monastic behavior is in its limiting choice and obliging those people who commit to doing and to accepting the Vinaya, constantly having to wake up moment after moment under various situations to having to ask themselves the question, is this useful? Is this going to be of benefit to self or other? Is it going to be not benefit to self and other? A monastic is constantly engaged on this very sharp edge of having to determine whether their behavior in thought, speech, and action is going to benefit themselves, benefit others, or benefit both. And in consequence, they are constantly being supported by Sampanjana. The vows themselves oblige them to embrace Sampanjana on a continuous basis. And it's really remarkable if someone really embraces, you know, really embraces the Vinaya. Whereas we lay people, our everyday lives don't afford us that opportunity. There's nothing in the suttas that give us that kind of permission to challenge ourselves at that type of an edge. And we have not a lot more time. Another significant aspect of the Vinaya, and also in terms of meditation, we learn very quickly, is our preferences of liking and disliking. Liking leads to grasping. Not liking leads to aversion. And both of them begin with either pleasant or unpleasant sensations. Understanding that, being present for our experience as soon as we possibly can, as to an experience being pleasant or unpleasant, gives us the opportunity of not letting things become liking, not liking, wanting, not wanting, attached or averse. The monastic is given that opportunity manifold. Over and over and over again throughout the day, they're obliged to do things that they don't like and have to watch them not liking it, or the unpleasantness of the experience, or the pleasantness of the experience. So having a lot of respect for how the monastics have to live, I began to look at my own life after retreat, increasingly from the perspective of what I could do in order for me to live a more structured and more accountable life to my everyday experience. And I also began to understand that This is a little part of a sutta. The Buddha says, "No other thing do I know, O monks, that brings so much harm as a mind that is untamed, unguarded, unprotected, and uncontrolled. Such a mind indeed brings much harm. No other thing do I know, O monks, that brings so much benefit as a mind that is tamed, guarded, protected, and controlled. Such a mind indeed brings great benefit." I began to understand after some years that if I allowed too many liking or disliking moments to arise, my behaviors became dramatically impacted further down with wanting and not wanting and being attached or wanting to push things away. And I decided that this was the practice that would perhaps benefit me in my everyday life more than trying simply to bring my attention to the sensations of my breath. If I'm walking, if I'm in a grocery store, it was more important to me to recognize that I liked the color of the cantaloupe because there was a pleasant sensation rather than necessarily looking at the cantaloupe and just seeing color. I began to understand that I had an accountability to every thought, every word that passed my lips, every action that I did. I had an accountability that I could look to see where the genesis of that experience came from. And it began to serve me ever more. It began to serve me fairly well. And Utejaniya says it like this. He says, "Think of your home as a retreat center. Begin by altering the way you see your home. When you begin to view your home in the same way that you view a meditation center, your practice will become smoother. Keep checking your attitudes and views. Keep checking your attitudes and views, your thinking, and your background ideas." So he's offering us the opportunity of paying attention with mindfulness and sampajana. And that's what we do with the Householder's Vinaya. In the Householder's Vinaya, we discuss these aspects that I've I've alluded to this evening to some to a fair degree, but the majority of the book is about delineating everyday life into 15 different categories, in which we are then able to look at those categories and begin to look at them and begin to use them as tools for waking us up to the appreciation of how big our responsibility is to pay attention to pleasant, unpleasant, liking, not liking, wanting, not wanting, clinging, and pushing things away. It is through this process that we can help liberate our minds in our everyday lives. Bhikkhu Bodhi says this: I should add that the venerable Jnanapanika himself did not regard mindfulness or sati or as capturing the complete significance of satipatthana, but as representing only one phase, the initial phase, in the meditative development of right mindfulness. He held that the proper practice of right mindfulness, sati, has to be integrated with sampajana, clear comprehension. And it is only when these two work together that right mindfulness can fulfill its intended purpose. Those are big words. That's a big statement. This is someone who's saying that right mindfulness, one of the Eightfold Path, right mindfulness is not complete unless we are also studying sampajana. Buddhaghosa says, in Buddhism, the essential meaning of the word study is the unceasing, dedicated observation and investigation of whatever rises in the mind, be pleasant or unpleasant. Only those familiar with the observation of mind can really understand Dhamma. We do our best, each of us, we do our best. But Buddhadasa is saying that every moment, every thought, every word, every action is an opportunity to bring Dhamma, bring Satisampanjana to our experience. And yet, just as the ocean has a gradual shelf, a gradual slope, a gradual inclination, with a sudden drop-off only after a long stretch, in the same way, this doctrine and discipline, Dhamma Vinaya, has a gradual training, a gradual performance, a gradual progression with the penetration to Nibbana only after a long stretch. The difference between a monastic and a layperson returning to their everyday life after retreat is in the continuity of our practice. We do our best. We do our best. And each of us will manifest our practice slightly differently, and we will make progress at varying degrees and at varying speeds. But it is important to acknowledge that those 23-1 odds towards allowing our minds to become more wholesome and for our concentrations to become stronger are better served if we fill those 23 hours with something more than just, oh, I'll sit 1 hour a day. We have 23 hours where we can be applying sampajana. And the householder's vinaya helps direct us in creating an environment that you yourself can make for yourself. And lastly, as I was just alluding to just a second ago, the Buddha compares his teachings to the rainfall that descends without discrimination on the earth. That this rain causes some seeds to grow into flowers and some into great trees implies no differentiation in the rain, but rather is due to the capacities of the seeds that it nurtures. Thus, the teachings of the Buddha is of a single flavor, but benefits beings in a variety of ways according to their capacity. I don't compare myself to a monastic. I take inspiration from the monastic, and I do the best I can. This lifetime I'm not a monastic. But they offer us, the Buddha offers us, a template that has been really effective for 2,600 years for the cultivation of wisdom and compassion and the attainment of enlightenment. It happens and has happened frequently within the context of the monastic orders of the Sangha. There has never been a generation like us. We as lay people have some of the same freedom and capacity to be able to structure our lives in profoundly spiritual ways. And the more we're able to integrate Sampanjana with our sati, or sati with our Sampanjana, in ways that make every moment accountable, we stand a much better chance, a much greater opportunity, the potential of our deepening our wisdom, compassion to the fruition and the promise that the Buddha offers us in terms of the various stages of enlightenment and jhana are ours. So with that, the Householder's Vinaya is available on Amazon, both paperback and ebook. And if you wish for a free download, you can go to householdersvinaya.com and you can get a PDF free download. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.